I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Wava Carpenter, the new artistic director at the Design Miami Fair. The 17th edition of the fair takes place in Miami Beach this week from December 1st through 5th.
Prior to her current role, she was a curatorial fellow at New York's Cooper Hewitt Museum and a professor of critical theory at Parsons New School of Design in New York. She is the co-founder of Anava Projects, an agency that focuses on supporting design for good.
Before we get into the episode, I'd first like to thank our sponsor, the Japanese watchmaker Grand Seiko, a renowned company that brings an incredible level of craft, detail, and design integrity to every watch it makes. Naturally, Grand Seiko is also a partner of the Design Miami Fair, where this year they will present an immersive installation created by the designers Boaz Cohen and Sayaka Yamamoto of the Amsterdam-based firm BCXSY.
Titled The Journey of Birch, the installation was inspired by Grand Seiko's new award-winning White Birch watch, which features a dial that takes cues from the birch trees surrounding the company's Shizuku Ishii studio, where it's made.
Upon walking into this space, visitors will experience an abstract version of a birch tree forest with indigo-colored panoramic murals. The centerpiece will be a three-ring clock that spans the height of the installation. Each ring will have a distinguished finished metal rod reminiscent of watch hands. These will travel at their own hour, minute, and seconds intervals, drawing circles in the sand that serves as the clock's base. Headphones will also be provided to experience the sounds of the clock hands.
In essence, the journey of birch is about engaging the senses of sight, touch, and sound. And much like what we do here on At a Distance, it provides a moment to contemplate the human relationship to nature and time. And now, our conversation with Wava.
Hi, Wava. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's going to be exciting to talk to you this way. I've never been on a podcast before.
Oh, amazing. So we're talking to you about 2 weeks before the opening of the Design Miami Fair. For those who aren't in the design world or aware of this, which may only be a small subset, I suppose, of our listeners, I was wondering if you could just talk about the fair. What's happening right now for you? What's your day-to-day like in the lead up to this?
Well, I mean, I think anyone who's worked on any event knows that the closer you get to the opening, the more just out of control it is, with so many final details to take care of and things that have to go to press and things that have to be published and tying up all the bows everywhere that need to happen. So it's nearly 24 hours a day job right now.
You've been involved with the Design Miami Fair previously in other roles. You worked on the show's programming, including design talks, design performances, design awards from 2006 to 2010. What's it feel like now to be kind of at the curatorial helm? How are you thinking about the fair now in comparison to the work you were doing more than a decade ago?
You know, it's a different company, but there's a lot of similarities to when I was with Design Miami in the beginning. I think I was actually the first official employee of Design Miami after the first show, which was in late 2005. Mm-hmm. I think that was done as a one-off, but it was so successful that it was like, okay, we have to like take this to Basel right away. So I was brought in. I was in New York and I moved down to Miami to help produce the first Basel show. And so at that time, it was a kind of startup, you know, before people were using the term startup so much. It was completely starting something from scratch. A lot of the world didn't really understand what collectible design was at that time, or that design objects could be sort of acquired through a gallery system. So at that time, it was really about just educating the public that this kind of work existed. And in fact, I did do curatorial work back then, putting together small shows, especially working with younger designers to kind of bring some flavor to help supplement kind of what was happening with the galleries at that time. That included talks programming. It included what we called design performances, where we had designers making design on site. So when I left full time after 5 years. I left completely after 7 years. The show was just already so grown up that sort of the message of collectible design was heard at that time. And so it was really about kind of elevating and refining what the show was all about. So for me, it felt sort of like, okay, my work is done. I'm going to move on to something else new. Mm. And so about 2 years ago, the director kind of brought me back in to do some consulting here and there. And it just sort of evolved back into a full-time position. But the company is really changing and growing. Again, it feels almost like a startup. In fact, there is sort of like intentions of really having a larger presence online and a larger internet business behind the live fairs. We're also moving into new locations. You know, we just closed the first show in Shanghai. We have plans to go other places as well soon. So I'm back at a time when it's kind of a startup again.
Mm. And run us through some highlights of this year's Miami show, you know, how they speak to this humankind theme. Maybe start with how you came up with the humankind theme in the first place.
So it kind of grew out of post-humanism ideas, which have been around for a long time. And for decades, that was really about humans needing to change their perspective relative to the natural world. You know, that problems that we're having environmentally can be sort of traced to the fact that humans have traditionally kind of thought of themselves at the top of a pyramid, right? And that the priorities for human life are sort of take precedence over everything else to our great detriment. So post-humanism is about flattening that hierarchy. But more recently, as outcries for social justice have become louder, the conversation has also moved into like flattening the hierarchies between humans as well. So the systems that have sort of favored some groups of people over others also need to be flattened in a way. So that's what the humankind theme is about. And it manifests in different ways. If you think about our brand partners, you know, Perrier Jouet has been increasingly interested in a more symbiotic relationship to nature, thinking about even the way they grow their grapes. So this year, they're partnering with the Austrian studio Miescher Traxler. And this sort of equity among species is rendered very visually in what they will show. So they have an installation where there are actual sort of 3D printed models of species. I mean, all sorts from the microscopic to animal life, plant life. But these little models are made all in exactly the same size in a way. Mm. And then there's a sort of projection where when you walk into the space, it kind of mirrors your body, except your body is made up of like all these different kinds of species. So it's very joyful and fun, but it kind of makes the message like completely understandable that we need to kind of think of ourselves interspecies wise, like all the same.
We've talked a lot about the microbial on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we got to think about the little ones we can't see, creatures great and small.
What I think is interesting that you've been putting out ahead of the show is this idea that we're going to be setting dialogues about the state of the world and what direction it should follow. And this is a great example that you just speak to, is this idea that conversations can begin. So the purpose of Design Miami is not just to sell stuff and not just to be a marketplace, but to begin conversations. So connected to this, what are some more of the pieces like the Miescher Traxler piece that you just talked about that you hope really spawn conversations beyond?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of installations, but I would like to talk about the talks program, which will be both in person and digital. For a number of talks, we've partnered with Deem Journal. This is a really great new publication that's biannual, I believe, that has to do with design as social practice. So Nu Gote from Deem Journal, one of the founders, he's leading a series of talks that are about envisioning equity through design work. He's going to appear in a number of talks, but we have this sort of digital series with a lot of interesting people. And some of the other topics that we will be covering include like othering queer aesthetics, the promise of vegan design, the psychedelic renaissance, sort of the promise of better mental health through microdosing. You know, Jean Lin of Colony is going to be speaking with Asad Skirt of El Decor, also about race and identity in our industry. So there's a lot of literal conversations that will be presented along with this show to hopefully move things forward in one way or another.
It's amazing how you're thinking about this broadly, that you're not just showing work, but you're hoping to create provocations at every touch point. So when you were, just to step back, when you were thinking about this year's show, were you thinking, how can you reach the people that aren't actually in Miami as well? You've mentioned this digital platform.
Exactly. Design Miami also has a sort of online magazine now. We've partnered with New Gote on editorial as well, which goes out to our newsletter followers and goes out to our social followers as well. The digital talks will go out as soon as the show opens, and our live talks will also be recorded and then put online as well. And, you know, Design Miami has a very privileged audience that has the means to actually change things. So I think it's really important to get these ideas in front of them as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get into a bit of some of the material. One typology or approach that I know that you've been interested in is ceramics, which has gained so much footing in the past couple of years. I mean, try to buy a kiln right now. You just can't do it. Are you seeing a lot more ceramics? And what do you think is possible in that medium that's relevant to the moment? What does that medium allow for?
Ceramics are so hands-on. You know, it's such a direct medium to mold and form. And it's a very personal medium as well. I mean, you usually do it very much alone as opposed to other kinds of sort of design work. And so it really lends itself to being a medium for storytelling, especially personal storytelling. There's so many ceramic artists right now who are really telling stories of their identity, their background. There's like activism being sort of imbued in clay right now. And I think people are drawn to that kind of personal story as a way to feel more connected to the world, maybe, but it's just a theory.
Well, it's interesting. It was probably one of the first forms of, you know, human expression was ceramics.
That's right.
Another, you know, strong contemporary concern connected to this is basically the relationship of the body to technology. Speaking of the primordial, this is not new. It's like the Paleolithic hand axe, you know, something designed for the body. How are you seeing this explored right now in design? And how is technology, you know, on the opposite end of ceramics, probably, how is technology and the body being explored this year?
In Design Miami this time, there's not that much that's really high tech right now. I'm seeing much, much more that's very much about the handmade, which engages the body more. You know, I mean, it's literally hands-on, whether it's wood or metal or clay or whatever the material could be. On the collectible side, it's just really all about the handmade right now.
Fascinating, because we are exiting a time where 3D and sort of periods of our obsession with technology, you know, maybe 5 years ago was really strongly represented.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to see the ways in which the design world, even at this level, is responding to the moment we're coming out of.
Yeah. I mean, so much of our engagement with the world right now is mediated by technology, right? I mean, we're speaking on Zoom now. I mean, everybody's up to their eyeballs with Zoom calls for work. You know, social media is how you sort of engage your friends most. So I think when it comes to these sort of three-dimensional objects in the real world, I think it's just going in the complete opposite direction. Like, we don't need any more celebrations of technology right now. Like, that's almost the status quo. What's exciting is something that feels older, more personal, you know, more hands-on.
Hmm. I wanted to expand out a bit from the fair and just sort of look at the past couple years, basically since COVID arrived in March 2020. In what ways are you seeing this moment, beyond what you already said about the fair, kind of being addressed through design? Like, what sticks out to your mind from the design community's reaction to COVID-19 so far?
I mean, I think we wanted to be very conscious to be upbeat, even as we are trying to put out very serious issues and get people to seriously think about serious, serious issues. But the sort of mood and the look of things, we feel people, you know, need a little joy in their life. We have a project that we're doing with the Design District with Studio Proba, whose work is like very colorful, very graphic, very fun. And it sets the mood right as you come in, because it'll be outside the tent at the entrance. And there's just so much work that will be in the show that has this kind of, it runs from like tongue-in-cheek to sort of fantastical fairy tale style kind of escapism that you see in all kinds of work. It could be like Misha Khan, that's very much the fantastical, but then there's all these other works that they almost look primordial, as we were saying before, or prehistoric. They, you know, are rocks kind of stacked on top of each other, like very monolithic, simple forms. And they all have a quality of being unlike our sort of everyday environment. And I mean, whether I chose the work or not to be in the show, it is everywhere right now, this sort of visually escapist quality in design work. Mm.
One of the reasons we were both so excited to talk to you today is because we can't think of anyone else who's had such a front row seat for what's happening inside of the design communities from the designers over the past maybe year or two, right? So one of the things we were curious about is, what effect, from what you've seen, do you think that the experience of lockdown, the experience of the last 2 years, has had on designers in terms of the way they work and collaborate, measure success, what they value? It seems to be that there's been this ideological shift from within design, the design community. What are you seeing? How are you thinking about that?
I am seeing creatives, you know, sometimes they call themselves artists, sometimes they call themselves designers, since I work in that sort of space in between. But more and more people are not shy about having a message, just the way Design Miami is right now. The designers themselves, the creators, want to use their platforms, their work, their collaborations to also bring some good into the world. There's any number of fundraisers that have come up. The work itself conveys messages. They're using their own social media platforms to put forward sort of calls to action. You know, a cynical person might think like it's sort of an overload and that it's being lost, but I don't think so. I think we've all been too quiet for too long, you know, even predating the pandemic, you know, going from the Trump years. You know, a lot of us just sort of woke up and are just like, we need to do more with what means we have any way we can to bring more voices in, to kind of direct people toward political actions that they can take, voting actions they can take. Anything you can do to grab an oar and move things forward. I feel that way. I see other curators feel that way. I see designers and artists feel that way. Like, everyone wants to move things forward in a big way. And so it's just about sort of making sure those messages penetrate as wide an audience as possible, and also the people who have the means to really make direct change as well.
And beyond that, how do you think companies are thinking differently now? I mean, things like lifespan, planned obsolescence, the need to design devices that last. You know, do you see a shift in the way companies are thinking about waste and objects that they put in the world? And do you think that the design community itself can have an effect on that?
I do see a shift. I mean, if you look at the entire landscape overall, the shift probably isn't happening fast enough. But, I mean, even if you look at the brands that are participating in Design Miami right now, I mentioned Perrier Jouet before, but, you know, Kohler is doing this really sexy sink with Daniel Arsham, but they are also donating to water NGOs, and they're putting that forward. USM has a program to help support young BIPOC creatives. There's a contest, and they're showing the winners of that contest. Companies are putting forward their social responsibility in a much more meaningful way. And on the product production side, you know, a lot more work can be done, but it's really exciting to see, you know, even watch companies, they're trying to get the plastics out of the ocean. You know, it's everyone is kind of pitching in a way that you wouldn't have seen 3-4 years ago.
Hey everyone, just taking a quick break to tell you about our new At a Distance book. It's our first book. We published it with our friends at Apartamento. And it features a curated selection of the interviews from this program over the past year and a half. It's condensed, edited, and distilled. It's a great collection of the best thinking shared by our guests, presented in digestible, short-form narratives. The book provides a hopeful, optimistic guide for today and tomorrow in a gorgeous flexi-bound volume. We're really excited about this. You can order your copy at slowdown.tv/at-a-distance-book or through Apartamento and select booksellers.
There's also a sort of altruistic bent to some of the work you've been doing. You're co-founder of Anava Projects, which is this agency that focuses on supporting design for good. Could you describe your work in this capacity? And I wanted to bring this up in the context of projects like Architects for Beirut, which was this art sale that raised more than $88,000 following the blast at the city's port, mm-hmm. or Design for Global Giving, another project that you oversaw that raised more than $30,000 for a COVID-19 relief fund. Mm-hmm. Do you view some of what you do as like curator, as activist? Is there an element to your practice that, and to, I guess, Design Miami too as a platform that you view as almost like a philanthropic endeavor, something that doesn't just create profit, but also gives back?
It's very important to me personally, but it's also very important for me not to put myself in the middle of that story. I think everyone should be doing their part to share the spotlight, to get resources where they are needed most. So I do take every opportunity I can. I wish I had more opportunities to do it, but I'm reluctant to talk about it in a way that makes it sound like I am doing something so amazing, you know. I'm doing what I can, you know, and I wish I could do more.
Mm. You also recently co-curated an exhibition, The New Guard, at Carpenter's Workshop Gallery here in New York. And, you know, this was really a project to support rising talent. Mm-hmm. What ties this show together with the work and who you selected? How does this particular group kind of represent where design, and particularly collectible design, is headed, or maybe reflective of the currents that we're seeing going through design right now?
Well, Carpenters asked me and my partner, Anna Karnick, in Anava Projects, to help them find some new talent in the U.S. You know, their program has been very European focused, as, you know, the collectible design world has been largely for a long time very Eurocentric. And it was an opportunity to not just find new talent, but to also expand the kind of work that's shown in that context, because the systems that support young designers in the U.S. versus Europe are very different, and they're not as robust. You know, the people who graduate from design school here have sort of less concrete work to show than, say, someone who graduates from Design Academy Eindhoven or the RCA. And there's a lot more focus on sort of woodworking, say, here. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that in Europe very much. You never saw wood in Carpenters before. So it was exciting to kind of look at these more hands-on ceramics, textiles, wood that mm-hmm. weren't in the Carpenters program before. But then also, you know, tying back to the pandemic and the sort of need for connection and the kind of interest now in design as autobiography, in a sense, mm-hmm. all of the designer artists that are in that show are really telling a personal story in one way or another. And they're all very different stories, you know, it's different backgrounds, different experiences, different interests, but they share this kind of thread where they're saying something about their life, what they've learned and what they value in the work that they create.
So I have an annoying question for you. Okay. So there's been this discussion for a long time between the design world and the art world, and you've got Basel across the street, and mm-hmm. Design Miami, and this sort of bifurcation of the two worlds. And there are artists who want to make functional objects, and there are designers who want to make art, basically. And it sits in this weird kind of place, right? And no one gets their head around it. Half the people don't care. I want to know from you, the artistic director of Design Miami, how you kind of are thinking about this, and when this kind of dumb discussion about what is design and what is art is going to end, and when people are just going to look at things and say, that's an object in the world for me to respond to. And, you know, when you're in industrial design, it's clear. This mm-hmm. thing is, you know, a pencil I'm holding is a piece of design.
Right.
It's not a piece of art. But honestly, walking around a lot of the work now, I just don't know.
I don't think that discussion and that question is ever going to go away. So, I mean, I mentioned, you know, starting off Design Miami in the early years in 2006. At that time, there was discussion of whether we should call this work design art. I don't know if you remember that. Nobody liked the term. It didn't stick. Collectible design seems to be where we are. Right now, a lot of the galleries are starting to call the work they represent functional sculpture. And I thought, like, can I help solve this problem?
It's got to get solved.
I really don't think it will be. I can tell you how it's solved in my head.
Right.
So I'm a design historian by training. That's what I studied in graduate school. So I take a very long view, you know, looking back to the pre-modernist era when, you know, the sort of idea of like decorative arts, your headboard might have a painting on it. And there's no real distinction and everything was kind of handmade and hands-on. And then as you get to the Industrial Revolution, you start to talk about the decorative arts and the applied arts as opposed to fine arts. And I feel very comfortable in that applied arts, decorative arts tradition. And part of the reason why is that the art world is just, it has its own systems. Like what's considered art? Who decides what is art? What art is considered important? Like there's a whole infrastructure there that it just is not touching the work that I'm working with in a way. It's excluded from that. I mean, in most cases, every once in a while, someone kind of crosses over and kind of exists in both worlds. But, you know, it's just a different system of galleries. It's a different system of discourse and media that's deciding what's good collectible design or not. You know, it has to do with auction houses as well as galleries, as well as publications. So I'm very happy calling something design when it doesn't sit into the official art world, but it has a sort of 3D quality. It has a function, even if it's not the most important thing about the work.
First of all, you're saying we're talking about a market. We're not talking about the work itself. That's yeah. One way to think about it. And the other way is that there's a long tradition of decorative arts that has function. And, you know, all of this becomes really market-driven. I mean, that's what the discussion's really about, because art can cost more than design can cost.
Yeah.
Somehow.
I know, and there's a lot of people making paintings that don't get sort of welcomed into the official art world as well. So I think you just have to acknowledge that there are these economic and cultural systems that decide what things are, and the work that I deal with doesn't fit into the art world very well, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I love looking at this conversation through Noguchi Zaikari sculptures, because in the 60s, he was selling them through Bergdorf's. And by 1986, he filled the entire U.S. pavilion at the Venice Biennale with them and called it art. So, you know, this is a conversation that does go back to the middle of the 20th century. I'm sure much further back. Yeah. But just through that lens, it's pretty fascinating.
I think it's also, you know, you can decide which label to use based on what the maker wants you to call it. I go by that criteria quite a bit.
Right, that the maker gets to decide what it is.
Exactly. You know, there are people making barely functional objects that kind of seem like chairs, but they're calling it design. So let's go with that.
Mm. Fascinating.
Weva, thank you so much for joining us today. And we're looking forward to coming to the fair.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope to see you in person there.
Thanks to our episode sponsor, the Japanese watchmaker Grand Seiko, which raises the pure essentials of watchmaking to the level of art. You can learn more about the company at grand-seiko.com. And thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv. This episode was produced by Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Pat McCusker.